My name's Christopher, and I've been working out here for 11 years now. And one of the things we've been looking at, you know, is in terms of, you know, we know the land is important to the people, and we also know that there was a treaty signed in 1863, a treaty of peace and friendship, signed over in Ruby Valley. That was an agreement between two nations, between two peoples. And you look at that treaty, and you can see that the Shoshone people made the Shoshone Nation made a lot of concessions in that treaty. They allowed the railroad to come across. They allowed the telegraph line to come across. They allowed white people to set up homes and ranches. They even agreed to allow mining to happen upon their lands. But nothing in that treaty says we give up our land. We give up our rights to use our land, to occupy our land, to prey upon our land. And, you know, here we are today, 140 years later. And the country that signed that treaty with the Western Shoshone people no longer has any desire to share that land with the original people. And so when I first came out here, you know, we started thinking about, well, why is it that the United States isn't willing to share the land with the Western Shoshone people? And so we started looking around and say, well, you know, who benefits from this situation? And it didn't take very long to realize that out in this part of the country, right now, the mining industry is benefiting from this situation. And what the U.S. has done is taken the land from the Shoshone people and has been, over the past 150 years, handing it off to mining people. And I should say mining corporations. It's not the people, it's the people that run these corporations. And so you had an agreement to share the land. You had an agreement to even allow mining. Now, I don't know how much folks know about the laws regulating mining upon the so-called public lands. The main law dates from 1872 and has not been significantly changed since 1872. And if you think about what was happening in 1872, tells you a lot about kind of the reasoning behind this law. Well, let's see, 1872, that was probably, what, a few years before Custer met his demise. There were Indian wars going on across the West. The U.S. military was actively dispossessing and destroying those Indian peoples that were unwilling to give up their lands. And there was this idea that the U.S., had this destiny, manifest destiny. They had this God-given destiny to go from coast to coast and conquer those lands and occupy those lands. And their laws reflected this philosophy. And so what the 1872 mining law did was it said, we want to exploit these lands and get our people out there as quickly as possible. And recognizing that in many of the arid lands across the West, the primary resource there was the mineral wealth of these lands. So what this law did is it said any U.S. citizen can come out to these lands, and if they find minerals on them, they can lay claim to those lands. And under the law, the government would grant property rights to the people that made these claims. And then under this law, not only through your mining claim do you get a property right to this land, but then the law actually allows the land, the title to the land, to be transferred from the U.S. government directly over to you as a miner. It's called patenting, and then that land becomes private property, your own private property. And in fact, just in this area, the old ghost town up the road here and the ghost town up the canyon there, that's private land. It was patented by the prior mining companies that were out here, so that's now private property. And so, you know, it's essentially a racist law, but the fact that it remains essentially unchanged over 130 years is a real testament to the power and the clout of the mining industry to protect their interests in the U.S. Congress. And so here you have Congress, you know, ostensibly our representatives. And this law, you know, says that we've all agreed to this, that we're all right with taking the land from one group of people, from the original people, and then handing it off to miners, to mining companies, just because there's minerals there. I mean, it basically says that the highest and best use of all the lands here in the West is their exploitation for minerals. Because it doesn't matter if there are burials on the site. It doesn't matter if it's a cultural site. It doesn't matter if you hunt there, you get your medicine there. None of that matters when it comes to the 1872 mining law. You know, we've been dealing with this for over a decade with the Bureau of Land Management. You know, constantly trying to protect the culturally significant things out there, whether it's the trees, the water, archaeological sites, whatever. That's all important. And every time we run up to it, the BLM always says, you know, there's really nothing we can do about it because of the 1872 mining law that says that that's the highest and best use of the land, and it says that the miners have a right to do this. They have a right. Now, we argue in court all the time that it's not a right, but effectively the government treats it as a right. And here, once again, you know, you have the government granting rights to relative newcomers on this land, and then you have the original people who become strangers in their own land and see their history consumed around them. And so, thinking about history, I think it's, you know, something that I've learned working in Indian country is the importance of knowing your history, knowing where you came from. Because, you know, if we don't know where we came from, we don't know where we're going. And we can't know where we are either. And so, for me, at least in my personal life, you know, the history, those stories can give you power. That's another thing I've learned. And, you know, I've had a lot of stuff shared with me. And these stories are good and they're bad. But nonetheless, knowing your stories can give you strength. And that's what I've seen, and I think that's why Mary and Carrie and the other Shoshone people have been able to survive the onslaught. You know, there's a storyteller and folk singer, Utah Phillips, and he's described history as a river which we can drink from and give us strength. And so it also gives us a reference point so we can know what's happened in the past. We don't know the good and the bad, the crimes and the lies that have happened in the past. We're quite apt to believe them, because those who do look at history start to see cycles repeating themselves, patterns repeating themselves. So this mountain here, long time ago, Gary probably told you some about it last year. People used to go up on top to pray. There's caverns inside that mountain. In fact, some of the historic mining shafts you see up on the side there, they penetrate those caverns. There's giant fissures and caverns in that mountain. And I understand back in creation times, those caverns played a role in the stories of the creation in this area. And what you find is that, you know, the people were spread out in every valley across New Osogobi. And each people, each family, each different valley had part of that creation story. And part of these different characters and coyotes moving across the landscape. So in this area, that creation story touches this mountain. And then, you know, other things, pine nut camps all through here. Pine nut camps, there's burials that have been identified. There's Nuwa burials up behind us here on the mountain, over on the other side over here. You look at the earliest white people's maps of this area. One of them was printed in 1868. And there's a little spring. You might have seen it driving up the road. There's a little cattle trough across the gully over here. And that's the only real surface water within a couple miles of this area. We have this 1868 map, and that map, that spring is on that map, and it's called Shoshone Wells. So around, and so people, you know, hunted here, they gathered here. There's all kinds of medicine around here. Different medicine plants grow up on that mountain. There's Indian tobacco, there's doza, there's yamba, which is a wild carrot, food plants, all kinds of other stuff. There's medicine rocks around here. So around time of that treaty, 1863, the same time they were forcing the Shoshones to sign a treaty at gunpoint in Ruby Valley, the first white miners showed up here around this mountain, 1863, and started mining. And you can see some of the remains of it up there on the mountain, the tailings coming out of some of the tunnels there. And in the process of doing this historic mining, now this was all underground mining. It's important to understand when that treaty was signed, the only understanding Shoshone people had with mining was these little holes in the ground, tunnels in the ground that the white people would dig. And so, you know, that was what was agreed to when that treaty was signed. Nobody had any idea that eventually whole mountains would be torn down, that holes several miles wide and over 1,000 feet deep would be dug into the land. So they also had to, in order to process the silver, they first came here for silver, and now they're here for gold. And they cut down all the trees. And in all the historic mining towns, including Cortez here, down at Austin and Eureka, for 50 to 70 miles all around these towns, the mountains were completely deforested. And all the pinyon and the juniper trees were cut down and turned into charcoal. And the charcoal was the fuel for the smelters. And, you know, you think about, you know, what kind of effect that had on the people. You know, here was their major food source, the pinyon tree. And then for just, you know, I can't imagine what it was like, you know, to see the extent of the devastation. And, in fact, we have, I've seen some photographs from the late 1800s of right where we are. And all these trees are cut down in those photographs. It's completely bare around here. But the important thing to remember is that those historic miners, they made little tunnels into the mountain. They left, the soil was still left here. And when the miners went away, the land had a chance to heal. And all this forest that we see now has grown back within the last 100 years. And when you all drive out of here and you go by the mines down in the valley, you know, I want you to think about that and think about how there aren't any forests that grow back after something like that. And that's really kind of what we're up against right now. There is a mine plan right now that if they've taken it back from the BLM because they actually want to submit an even larger mine plan. But the last one they had submitted would result right now, if they had their way, where we're sitting, we'd be under a 300-foot pile of waste rock, or a similar pile of rock that was being saturated with cyanide. All the trees you see in back of us there, below those cliffs, would be the open pit. And now, the way it's looking, the pit would extend from right in back of us pretty much down to the old mine at the bottom of the valley. And they'd leave those pits forever, as it's too expensive. Put the dirt back in the hole once you're done. And so we've been trying to, you know, address this issue. Because here you have, you know, just a little bit about the historic mining, too. When the miners came here, like I said, they put the shafts in the mountain. But what's unique about this place was that there was a large Chinese community here as well. And you remember, we brought the Chinese people in to build the railroad across the country. And then, of course, once the railroad was done, we didn't really have any use for the Chinese people, but they were stuck over here. So they would they moved to the edges of the mining communities and made their existence on the periphery of mining towns, which actually was what many Shoshone people were forced to do as well. And the archaeological record in this area demonstrates both of that, and that just in this gully across from our camp here, you'll find a fenced area. And that's one of the old Chinese villages. It was in that area there, and you'll find there's some old wells there. There's foundations and stuff. And there was another one up towards the ghost town up this way. And what's interesting is that, much like now, it was a pretty racist time back in the late 1800s here in Eureka County. And down in the town of Eureka in the 1870s, there were several basically lynching parties, and there were Chinese people that were taken by mobs and lynched. However, up in this area here, the Chinese people persisted probably up until around 1900 or so, until even the early 1900s, there was still a Chinese community living here. And what I've read, and don't know how much the truth of it was, but the original owner of the mine here, Simeon Wenbin, was very sympathetic to the Chinese people and treated them fairly well. So even when the mineral prices were such that it wasn't practical to pay the white miners to work, the Chinese people persisted in this area and continued to work the tailings and continued to work the area and keep things going, even in the slumps. And so, you know, here's a history. You know, one of the things we talk about is that the history has been written across the land, that all these archaeological sites that are out here, that's part of the story of the people's living here, the people's story here. And in the same way, what remains of those Chinese towns, that's part of the story of what's happened here. Just as the ruins of the old mining town up there are part of the story of the hard work and the struggle of those immigrants, because many of these miners were immigrants. There were a lot of Welsh and Cornish people from England who have a history of mining back to Roman times that came here to operate these mines. And if you look up in the ghost town, you'll see a lot of stonework. You know, all that stonework was done with hand. You know, people put their spirit into it. And other things about this mountain, you go up on the mountain, there's fossils all over the mountain. There's sea fossils way up high on this mountain. You can find trilobites and different plants in the shale formations. A little bit that I know of creation time that I've been told out here talks about a time when all the land was covered with water and there were just islands all around. And the archaeologists like to say that the Shoshones are relative newcomers to this place, that they've only been here for maybe 2,000 years, and that they invaded from California and took over this landscape a couple thousand years ago. But I always wonder, how is it that their creation stories talk about a time when there was all this water and these islands? And if you know the geological history of the Great Basin, you know that there are immense inland seas here, that the Great Salt Lake and Pyramid Lake are the remainders of enormous inland seas, and that these valleys, all these valleys here, had huge lakes in them. There's still the dry lake bed here in Grass Valley. So the geological history tells us that long, long time ago, this landscape was mostly water with the mountain ranges as islands. Long before 2,000 years ago. So here's, you know, the people have a memory of this place that obviously shows they've been here longer than the archaeologists are willing to admit right now. And the fact that there's ocean fossils up way on the side of this mountain, you know, is yet more evidence, you know, of this. And goes to show more the uniqueness and the specialness of this place. And so, you know, here we have all this history, different people's history, you know, written across this landscape. And our congressman here in Nevada, Jim Gibbons, former mining geologist, last summer submitted legislation, unbeknownst to anybody, real quietly submitted a bill to Congress. And what this bill would do, And it's important to note that this bill was submitted to Congress about 2 months after we had our first spring gathering on this site right here. And what this bill would do would be to sell Placer Dome Mining Corporation approximately 100,000 acres of land within Western Shoshone Territory, including 60,000 acres here in Crescent Valley, including all the land that we're sitting on right now, including this whole mountain, would be theirs. And it would be sold for just the surface value of the land. Wouldn't want to consider all the mineral value. Just from looking at their press releases and their new find up here, inside this mountain right now, there are billions of dollars worth of gold. Billions of dollars worth of gold. And out in this part of the country, it's the mines that call a lot of the shots and have enormous clout. And we're always dealing with water quality issues, and the state is very reluctant to prevent water contamination, prevent the destruction of cultural sites. I've been told off the record behind a closed door by Nevada state regulators that it's not their, that their job is to promote mining. And these are the people that are responsible for the enforcement of the air and the water and the various laws under state law. Another thing about when it happened, when these projects happen on so-called public land, federal land, there are federal laws that require the consultation with Native peoples when there are projects that could affect resources important to those peoples. So when they do build these mines now, they, the government at least has to consult with the Shoshone. They have to say, well, this is what we're going to do, this is where we're going to do it, and do you have any concerns about it? Are there things that are important out there for you? That's a frustrating process, because every time we say there's something important, then they say, well, there's really nothing we can do about it, but we're just required to ask you anyway. But nonetheless, it provides information, it provides a certain amount of transparency so people can start to understand what's happening. And it also is a tool for us to educate the tribal councils and other tribal members about what's happening out there on the land. If all this land is privatized, that doesn't happen anymore. They don't have to talk to Indian people. They can do whatever they want. They have to talk to the State Historic Preservation Office, which is more concerned about preserving historic mine sites than Native American cultural areas. So it would be a really bad thing if they were able to privatize this, and that's part of what we're fighting. Now, at the same time, it was well known by the BLM that this was a culturally significant area. There are stacks of ethnographic reports and archaeological reports that we have that clearly demonstrate both the historic and the continuing use of this area. Shoshone people still hunt here. They still gather here. They get firewood here. In some years, they even get pine nuts around here. They still get medicine here. They still pray here. And Mr. Gibbons knew that, and that's why I think he did this stealth-wise, because they didn't want to confront this issue. They didn't want to deal with that. And it's still in Congress, as one other co-sponsor, Mr. Cannon out of Utah. And the Cortez joint venture is actually Placer Dome and Kennecott. And, of course, Kennecott has a long history in Utah, which probably explains Mr. Cannon's support for the bill. But what's particularly disturbing is that Mr. Gibbons has described this bill as the model for the reformation of the 1872 mining law. So Mr. Gibbons' idea of reforming the mining law is essentially to sell all the lands that the mines want and have claims on to the mining companies. That's reform. And if Placer Dome is able to privatize all the land that it has claims on, well, certainly it would only be fair that Newmont gets to privatize all the land around its mines, and Barrick should be able to get the same thing, and Homestake, and Glamis, and everybody else. And a large part of Shoshone territory has mine claims all over it. In fact, probably, you know, at least a third of it has mine claims all over it. So this could set a very, very dangerous precedent if this bill were to succeed. Now, just recently, the BLM has nominated parts of this mountain as a traditional cultural property. Now, under the National Historic Preservation Act, there's a special designation recognizing the importance of areas to Native American people, and that's what a TCP, a traditional cultural property, is. So we've been working for years now trying to provide that documentation of this continuing use and occupancy of this area and the significance of this area. And we've run up against a lot of roadblocks and people trying to prevent this from happening, including a former tribal chairman of the Timok tribe of Western Shoshone. And just to illustrate you a little bit of the kind of things that we have to deal with, last September, the environmental staff person for the Timok tribe, really intelligent, good young woman named Jennifer Bell, she's actually a descendant of the Timok family who signed the treaty, was working to collect the information about the significance of this area, and in fact worked with us and other Shoshone people to show that the area of significance actually includes where we're at, the mountains behind us here, as well as the whole Mount Tanabo and some of the canyons to the east of it. And she made a presentation to the tribal council, did a wonderful job, got the council to approve, support the designation of this area as a traditional cultural property. Well, the tribal chairman has had a very close and cozy relationship with the Placer Dome Mining Company. And in fact, when we first started challenging the new mine that you've passed, the gigantic one down in the valley, that was built in late 1996. They started building that. So it gives you an idea of the amount of earth they can move in a short amount of time. When they first started planning that, and we started being vocal about it, and we had the Dans were speaking out against it. There were Shoshone people from communities all around here, Battle Mountain and Duckwater. As far as Duckwater, people testified at public hearings about the potential for this mine to damage the water and the cultural areas, et cetera. And Mr. Ike was chairman at the time as well. And despite all these tribal members that were speaking out against it, Mr. Ike cut a deal with the mine. And before we knew it, there was a letter on tribal letterhead saying, we think this is a great project and we have no concerns whatsoever and there's no cultural areas that we know of, signed by a chairman who doesn't even come from here, that comes from 150 miles south of here. That's where his family comes from. And so then every time it was raised that, well, there are Shoshone concerns about this, the mine and the BLM would pull out the letter and say, here's the letter from the official chairman on tribal letterhead that says there are no concerns. So who cares what the Dans say or a couple tribal members, because we have the official spokesman saying that everything's okay. Well, anyways, jump back to last year. After Jennifer made a presentation and the council passed a resolution supporting it, apparently, Mr. Ike wasn't at the meeting or had left the meeting before this was done, because when he found out about it, he wrote a letter once again on tribal letterhead as chairman to the BLM saying that this resolution's illegal and that we have no concerns and that they had no right to ask that this area be protected. And then that was followed by the vice chair writing to the BLM and saying, Mr. Ike has no right to veto the lawful action of the tribal council. And so this is, you know, at the same time we're working to try to protect this, we have people, the Shoshone people, for various reasons, trying to undermine that. And it makes it real hard. And just like the money divides the people, this again divides and weakens the people. And it's demoralizing. And it's real hard. But that's par for the course, I guess. So anyways, we're working to, you know, we're going to work and try to get that area that's designated as a traditional cultural property. What the BLM did conveniently is said, we'll consider from the cliffs over there up to the top of the mountain and the canyon on the other side to be the traditional cultural property. But conveniently, right down here where they want the mine to be, well, that doesn't qualify as a traditional cultural property. You know, despite the fact that there's Shoshone camps there, there's continuing use, etc. So part of the job ahead of us here is to gather more documentation and argue that, no, you can't just say that part of the mountain's important and the rest isn't, because we know everything's connected. So you got a lot of mines that have a lot of money to make and don't want to share it with the Western Shoshone. Now, another thing that's going on, because it's not just the mines. There's a big move right now to develop geothermal power. Because of the California energy crisis, there's a lot of pressure to build power plants in the neighboring states to California to export power to California. We're already seeing proposals in the western part of the state for coal-fired plants to provide for California. And then there's been a big push for geothermal. And then both Senator Reid and Congressman Gibbons have been pushing this nationally. And in fact, Senator Reid has stated that Nevada could be the Saudi Arabia of geothermal energy production. And, you know, the first thing I thought of is, well, who gets to be the sheik? And unfortunately, it's not the people and it's not the Shoshone as far as we can tell. Mr. Gibbons has, well, first a little bit about geothermal power. So I've been through a crash course in geothermal power in the past year, and we've had a lot of assistance from a San Francisco-based research organization called the Data Center that put together a little report for us and kind of gave us an education on geothermal power production. Now, geothermal power is being promoted as green energy, and in fact, they've even called it renewable energy. And compared to a coal-fired power plant, the emissions coming off a geothermal plant are pretty tame in comparison. Problem is that geothermal energy so far has not been a renewable resource. We can extract the heat from the ground much faster than Mother Earth replaces it. And that's been demonstrated at most of the geothermal plants across the West, in that when you build a geothermal plant, in the early years of the plant, you get the most energy. And as time goes on, the amount of energy produced by this gets less and less. And invariably, the springs or geothermal areas associated with the plants are affected. On your drive down here, if you came down from the highway, you cross the railroad tracks in a little place called Beowawe. Beowawe had the second largest geyser system in North America after Yellowstone Park. And there were geysers there that would shoot meters and meters to the air. And in fact, the oral history says that they used to shoot all the way over the mountain. And if you look at the mineralization up on the hill above those springs, you can see that that was true, that there, a long time ago, there was water getting way, way up there. And in the research we've done, we have photographs of those geysers from the 1940s. Well, starting in the 50s and 60s, they started developing the area for geothermal power, and then and finally in the early 1980s, Chevron built a power plant and tapped off those geysers. And there's no more geysers. There's no more hot water there. You can go out there, and there's these big holes in the rock where the water used to come out with. Now they're just full of tumbleweed. And those geysers, they were part of the creation story out here. There are all these little hot waters and geysers there. And all the different people that were part of the creation, all the different characters, they all had their own little hot hole there. Some of them were hot enough that you could cook in. You could cook in that water. And in fact, there's archaeological sites all through there. You can see on one of the springs where an Indian bathtub was built to bathe there. And again, nobody asked the Shoshones what they felt before they tapped off these things and destroyed this resource. Well, you know, some people would say, well, no, we made use of this resource. You know, now we have our lights. And that's what's in store for the rest of the hot springs across the state. And you also have the issue is that many of these hot springs are in remote areas. So you're talking about the construction of power lines and the industrialization of these remote valleys. In fact, right where we're at now, about 7 miles down the valley, off to the west side, at the southern end of the tip of Bald Mountain, where it comes down to the dry lake bed, there's another set of hot springs there that Shoshone people used to do mud baths in. That's up for a geothermal lease right now by the BLM. There's a hot spring a mile away from the Dan Ranch where the family bathes that their father, Dewey Dan, developed. There's a geothermal lease proposed for that. I live at Hot Springs over in Hot Springs Point, and even though that's all private property, BLM still owns the geothermal rights. There's a proposal for that. And this is all being promoted under the guise of, oh, this is renewable energy, this is green energy, this is all good. So Gibbons has a bill, another one of his brilliant schemes, to promote this geothermal energy development. So what does it do? Well, it gives government subsidies, public money to promote the creation of these plants. It would have the public pay for all the environmental studies that would be required for the development of these plants. And then it would waive any royalties that the public got. And again, this is the public. This isn't the Shoshone. This is the public, aka the government. That would get any royalties, but under current law that there would be royalties under geothermal production. Well, Mr. Gibbons' bill would waive any royalties for the first 10 years of the life of the geothermal plant. And what we found out is that would be the most productive period of energy production is the first 10 years, and then the years afterwards, the energy production would go down. But that, under Gibbons' bill, that's when the royalties would kick in, when the energy production went down, which is great for the energy companies, but kind of sucks for everybody else. They would also allow the company, once a company signs a lease with the BLM, the BLM wouldn't be able to modify the lease for any reason without the consent of the company. So say they have a lease, and all of a sudden they find out that there are associated environmental impacts. Maybe there are other nearby springs that are being dried out because of the geothermal development. Well, the government couldn't change that lease unless the energy company agreed to it. But then the kicker is that under his new amendments, it would allow the companies to change their lease, you know, which is like kind of a temporary rental agreement. It would allow them to transfer the lease into a mining claim under the 1872 mining law. So then it would go from renting to owning these hot waters. And then they could privatize them, and then it's theirs. And that's what the current, his bill, his proposal to amend the Geothermal Steam Act, that's the general gist of that, and all being promoted under the guise of green energy. Effectively, what it would do is provide subsidies for mining companies to build geothermal power plants to power their mines, and that's, in fact, just what they want to do in Crescent Valley, in that the Cortez Gold was looking at the possibility of developing the Dan's Hot Spring for geothermal power. And the mine already owns 49,000 acres in this valley, including all the private property completely surrounding the Dan Ranch. So they have 49,000. Gibbons would give them another 60,000 acres in this valley. It's 109,000 acres, which is more land than all the Shoshone reservations within the treaty area combined. And that's just in this valley. And this isn't even the biggest mine in this area. Far bigger mines along the Carlin Trend. So you can kind of see how the power flows around here. But we're standing up against it, and we're trying to speak out, and we're trying to say that there is other value out here on this land other than just the minerals, other than just the electricity we can extract from this. And there are people that have been here forever that that value these things and still use these things and have every right to have those things protected for their future generations and for our future generations. And so those are just kind of two of the related bills that kind of put this claims bill into context. So what's this big rush to pay the Indians off? Well, if you look at the claims money compared to the actual value of the resources on this land, whether it's the energy resources in the form of oil or geothermal or mineral resources in gold, that this claims money is just a tiny, tiny pinprick, drop in the bucket compared to what's out here. And so once again, we want to pay the Indians off cheap so we can get along with making our American dream happen out here and exploiting all these resources. And again, you know, as an American person, which I'm reluctant to admit, but I was born into it, you know, this is being done in our name for the public benefit. And so it's up to all of us to do something about changing this because it's being done in all of our names. Yeah, and one of my colleagues, I'm on the board of Great Basin Mine Watch, and you probably heard one of my colleagues, Christy, speaking yesterday, and she has some draft letters and information available. Christy's right in back of us there. And Great Basin Mine Watch is helping us address these issues and has been ever since when it was created in the mid-90s as a coalition between Western Shoshone people, environmental people, and even ranchers to address some of the negative impacts of mining, and particularly the new mine that has been built here in Crescent Valley, in which we're still dealing with ongoing water contamination. And it just doesn't make sense to contaminate water in the driest state in the nation, or for that matter, anywhere on the planet, considering how little drinkable water is on the planet. So anyways, I rambled along long enough, and I'm going to let Carrie say a few words. We've got some literature on the raffle table. We co-published a report several years ago with a great organization, which unfortunately no longer in existence, called Project Underground, which was created to support communities that were dealing with the impacts of mineral and oil development. And so we did. I did a lot of research on the history and related the history of the treaty and the Shoshone history to the history of the mine development out here. And it's called Digging Holes in the Spirit. And we take donations for them, but if you really want it and you don't have $5 to give us, just take one. I'd much rather, you know, if you want it, I'd much rather have you have it than $5 in our donation jar. And then also our website, WSDP.org. A lot of this information, in fact, that whole report is up on the website as well. And there'll be additional information on the Geothermal Act, and I think there's already stuff on the Placer Dome bill up there as well. So, you know, we really need to speak out and let the so-called congressional representatives, leaders, know that this is unacceptable, that there's more value out here than just the gold, and that it shouldn't always be the gold that rules. So anyways,